Afternoon, it's a minute before 12. Thanks for tuning in. This is Public Radio KMXT Kodiak 100.1 FM, live on the web, kmxt.org. Translators in the villages, K269AW Larson Bay, K269AX Carla, K269AY Akiak, K269AZ Old Harbor, and K220AU in Port Lyons. Currently 44 degrees, light rain, fog, mist out at the airport. About the same here on Signal Hill, it's kind of steadily raining. Visibility at the airport's down to 4 miles. We might be at that much right now. It's 85% humidity, a northeast wind 15 miles an hour blowing. Supposed to have showers and clouds all day with a high near 48. Northeast winds 20 miles an hour, chance of precipitation 70%. Drops down to 50% tonight, scattered showers, cloudy skies, a low around 44. Northeast winds 15 to 20 miles an hour. Stays the same tomorrow, showers likely before 10 in the morning, then clouds, high up near 50, northeast winds 15 to 20 miles an hour. Rain Thursday, 90% chance of it happening, 80% chance on Friday. Rain likely on Saturday, and a chance of rain on Sunday. Great gardening weather. Chiniac Bay this afternoon, northeast winds at 20 knots, 6-foot seas, rain showers. Marmot Bay, northeast winds, 20 knots, 7-foot seas, rain showers. May the 5th, Tuesday it is. Going to be going into headlines from NPR and then the local news. Talk of the Rock today, I think we're going to be talking Shakespeare's. Tune in for that. Let's check out what's happening around the globe first from NPR.
Live from NPR News, I'm Lakshmi Singh. A government scientist who used to help oversee federal development of coronavirus drugs and vaccines has formally filed a whistleblower complaint. Rick Bright claims he was ousted after he challenged the Trump administration's insistence that hydroxychloroquine should be used to treat COVID-19, even though there has been little scientific data showing the antimalarial drug works. Bright says he was punished for resisting political pressure. President Trump has said he's not familiar with the circumstances surrounding Bright's departure. The administration's also firing back against reports of an internal document that indicates officials privately projected the death toll from COVID-19 would be worse than what had been publicly disclosed. NPR's Nurit Eisenman explains.
The document, first obtained by the New York Times and published Monday, includes projections that by June 1st, every day, more than 200,000 people in the U.S. will get infected with coronavirus and more than 3,000 people will die. On Tuesday, White House Press Secretary Kayleigh McEnany said in a statement that the estimate, quote, is in no way representative of any federal government projections. And she said it was done as if absolutely no mitigation measures would be taken. The epidemiologist who produced the projections for the federal government, Justin Lessler of Johns Hopkins, tells NPR they were based on the assumption that at least some measures would be in place. But he says the projections were still very much a work in progress, and he doesn't know how they got included in the document. Nurit Eisenman, NPR News.
The nominee for the nation's top intelligence job appeared today in a Senate hearing room that was largely empty due to physical distancing. Small groups of senators rotated in and out to question John Ratcliffe, the Texas Republican congressman nominated for the post. We have more from NPR's Greg Myrie.
Most members of the Senate Intelligence Committee wore masks during the confirmation hearing of John Ratcliffe, President Trump's choice to be Director of National Intelligence. A few senators wore them over their faces while asking questions. Others just left them hanging around their necks. Democrats repeatedly asked Ratcliffe, a staunch Trump loyalist, whether he would tell the president information that Trump does not want to hear.
As DNI, you have my commitment to deliver timely, accurate, and objective intelligence and to speak truth to power.
The Senate's Republican majority all but ensures Ratcliffe's confirmation, even if all Democrats oppose him. Greg Myrie, NPR News, Washington.
Another Trump nominee is seeking Senate confirmation to oversee a significant portion of the $2 trillion economic relief package. Brian Miller told the Senate Banking Committee he promised as Inspector General to conduct fair and impartial audits and investigations. But congressional Democrats questioned the veracity of that claim. Miller was a lawyer in the White House counsel's office and was also a part of President Trump's impeachment defense team. You're listening to NPR News. The nation's services sector shrank last month for the first time since the Great Recession. NPR's Scott Horsley reports on how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting service industries.
Service-oriented businesses contracted sharply in April as widespread stay-at-home orders sent the U.S. economy reeling. An index compiled by the Institute for Supply Management shows deep declines in business activity, new orders for services, and employment. The Institute reported a similar decline in manufacturing businesses last week. Among services, nearly every industry saw its business suffer, including restaurants, retailers, education, and entertainment. One exception was finance. Many bankers kept busy during the month, processing applications for emergency government loans. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
California is suing Uber and Lyft for allegedly misclassifying drivers as independent contractors. State Attorney General Javier Becerra says the ride-hailing companies, which do not pay into unemployment funds for the drivers, are both exploiting them and shifting costs to taxpayers. The state is seeking $2,500 in penalties for each driver plus back wages. Russian President Vladimir Putin has awarded a World War II medal commemorating victory over Nazi Germany to North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. According to a statement out of the Russian embassy in Pyongyang, the medal was given to Kim for his role in preserving the memory of Soviet soldiers who died on North Korean soil. Kim did not attend the ceremony. Earlier this month, he was rumored to be ill. You're listening to NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Doctors Without Borders, whose teams are responding to the coronavirus pandemic in more than 70 countries while continuing to provide care to people trapped in crisis and conflict at doctorswithoutborders.org.
NPR News is brought to you in part by Providence Kodiak Island Counseling Center. For an appointment or more information, 481-2400.
The local news is supported in part by Ardinger's Fine Furnishings, home of the Tempur-Pedic Ergo Collection and the Tempur-Pedic Breeze, made especially for those who sleep hot. The Breeze cushions and supports you while channeling excess heat away from the mattress. Tempur-Pedic's Ergo Base allows you to move the bed into multiple ergonomic positions for sleeping or relaxing. 486-5554.
And by Arctic Physical Therapy Services, Incorporated. Professional rehabilitation for all your physical therapy needs. We repair the world's most complex machine. 813 Mill Bay Road, 486-4499.
Thank you. First, the good news. Today, yesterday, the Alaska Congressional Delegation welcomed a $20 million purchase of Alaska pollock by the United States Department of Agriculture under Section 32 of a program that was designed to assist. That's the good news. Demand for flights on Alaska Airlines is less than 10% of normal, according to a report just released today from the airline's parent company. Alaska Air Group attributes the sharp decline to unprecedented impacts from COVID-19, which caused a sharp decline in passenger bookings during the first 3 months of 2020, continuing into April and May. Alaska Airlines CEO Brad Tilden called the pandemic, quote, one of the greatest challenges in the history of commercial aviation, close quotes. In its quarterly report, Alaska Air Group noted a net loss of $232 million. That's compared to a reported profit of $4 million from the same time period last year. $4,232 million. Alaska Airlines has parked more than 150 aircraft, cut its overall number of flights, and expected further significant reductions in May and June. Airline reported receiving $992 million in federal CARES Act funding in late April. Meanwhile, the airlines is looking at using passenger jets to fly cargo, with company photos showing packages sitting in seats instead of people. And like other airlines, Alaska is requiring passengers who are still flying to wear masks on its planes. United States Missile Defense Agency is inviting public feedback on two documents related to a testing program the agency plans to conduct this fall on a new radar facility at Clear Air Force Station. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
Missile Defense Agency officials announced Monday they're accepting public comments through June 2nd on the proposed final environmental assessment and a proposed finding of no significant impact. The two documents were prepared by MDA and the Air Force and Federal Aviation Administration, and they outline how the testing of the long-range discrimination radar at CLEAR will be conducted and possible impacts of the tests. The testing must be successfully completed before the radar facility can be integrated into the U.S. missile defense system. Among other things, the tests would include imposing a temporary flight restriction around CLEAR that would ban any private or commercial aircraft from entering the airspace while tests were underway. Copies of the documents are available at city offices in Anderson and Nenana and the Denali Borough Office in Healy. They've also been sent to Civil Air Patrol officials and aviation advocacy organizations like the Alaska Aircraft Operators Association. Comments on the proposals must be submitted by either email or regular mail and received or postmarked by June 2nd. The email and regular mail addresses and other contact information are available on the KUAC website at fm.kuac.org. In Delta Junction, I'm Tim Ellis.
Coast Guard Air Station Kodiak helicopter experienced a mishap on Sunday afternoon during a training exercise on Cape Chiniac, about an hour's drive from city of Kodiak. None of the crew were injured. A team of two pilots and one crew member were practicing landing on an MH-60 Jayhawk helicopter in a confined area early Sunday afternoon when the aircraft hit some trees. Here's Coast Guard Petty Officer Nate Littlejohn.
The helicopter rotor blades made contact with some trees and sustained damage. The aircraft landed safely following the mishap.
Littlejohn said no one was reported injured, but the crew members were taken to a medical clinic on the base as a precaution. The Coast Guard is investigating the cause of the accident, which is currently unknown.
It's interviewing people involved. It's people going to the scene to investigate evidence, to look at damage to, in this instance, trees, and to the aircraft as well.
The damaged helicopter is still parked on land owned by Lesnoy Native Corporation. Littlejohn said the Coast Guard has an agreement with the corporation to use its land for training. Other than the trees hit by the helicopter blades, he said no land or infrastructure was damaged. Helicopter is still being assessed for damage beyond the rotor blade, said Littlejohn. He says it's not yet clear whether it can be fixed on site or whether it will have to be transported back to the base for repairs. Littlejohn says Coast Guard helicopter mishaps are pretty rare. However, this is the second helicopter mishap in a little over a year after a Kodiak-based MH-60 sustained damage while on the ground in Cordova last April. Few details were released about that incident. No injuries were reported, and the helicopter has since been repaired. Littlejohn said Sunday's mishap is not related with the incident in Cordova a year ago. The Alaska Association for Historic Preservation, AAHP, announced their 2020 10 Most Endangered Historic Properties on Sunday to kick off Historic Preservation Month. The annual list was announced on the organization's Facebook page and can be found on their website, AAHP. AAHP listed the Ascension Church of Our Lord Chapel, located at Karlik, as the property most at risk. The church is the oldest Russian Orthodox church in Alaska, having been built in 1888. Situated overlooking the Karlik River, the church is in danger of sliding off the cliff that is being undercut by the Karlik River. Almost equally in danger of being lost is the Wolf Creek's Boat Works, located near Hollis on Prince William Island. The organization rated it as second in danger of being lost. Due to a pending land exchange, the facility may be destroyed and lost to Alaska's history forever. This isn't the first time Alaska has dealt with a pandemic. Widely shared news clips on social media show the striking similarities between the current coronavirus pandemic and the influenza pandemic over a century ago. K2 Pablo Pena went looking for lessons that could be learned from the mother of all pandemics.
It's October 1918 in Juneau, and the future of Alaska depends on which comes first, winter or the so-called Spanish flu. At that time, the flu had already been ravaging the outside world, infecting one-third of the global population. It added to the tragic loss of human life in World War I, which was about to end. When it was all over, records show at least 50 million total deaths from the flu worldwide. Newspapers report hundreds of infections and 350 deaths in Seattle. But despite the community's best efforts, the first influenza case in Alaska was reported in Juneau on October 14, 1918, before winter stopped ships from coming.
So the main thing was is that ships leaving Seattle, if they would do a visual inspection of everyone getting on the ship, and if they looked sick, then they would be told they couldn't go. And obviously the problem with that is that a lot of people didn't show symptoms until they were already up here.
That's Nico Sanguinetti. She's a curator at the Juneau Douglas City Museum. Sanguinetti says there are many historical parallels between the influenza pandemic over a century ago and the coronavirus pandemic today. Articles from the Alaska Daily Empire paint a gloomy and eerily familiar picture of Juneau during the flu pandemic. Stories of schools shutting down, businesses closing, and mandatory self-quarantines.
Some of these newspaper articles honestly could be printed 2 days ago. The same mentality, the same fears, the same concerns, the same uncertainties. It's very creepy.
Haida tribal elder Tom Abel says his Aunt Carrie witnessed the flu pandemic firsthand as it spread through southeast Alaska.
She kind of described the situation to me, you know, as that people were dying so fast that they couldn't bury them and bodies were rotting in the streets and in the, you know, were literally rotting where they dropped.
Abel's family survived in isolation. But going into 1919, whole villages in Alaska were decimated as the second wave of influenza traveled on ships and dog sleds up north.
It made its way all the way up to the Seward Peninsula and ravaged northern Alaska, killing, you know, devastating villages.
Catherine Ringsmith is an Alaska historian at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Her family operated the Diamond Cannery in Bristol Bay. Today, as residents are talking about opening up fishing communities in Bristol Bay, the fear of a second wave of COVID-19 is very real. Ringsmith says for many Native Alaskans, the flu came with the history of colonization.
This was a terrible, terrible disease that wiped out the heart and soul of the population and left behind a population of orphans.
Historical documents show gruesome scenes. Cannery workers found orphans left to fend for themselves, surrounded by dogs and the remains of their relatives. Overall, the flu killed a greater percentage of people in Alaska than in any other state or territory in the U.S., except for Samoa. But Ringsmith says the survival stories of those orphans in the face of a pandemic would inspire generations.
And yet those courageous kids survived, and not only survived, they would go on to give birth to a generation that's, you know, going to lead Alaska into the Anska days and Anilka and subsistence and becoming some of the most powerful indigenous people on the planet.
Stories that go to show that in times of great tragedy, there are also extraordinary triumphs. In Juneau, I'm Pablo Peña.
Thank you, Pablo. Authorities are working to track and kill an invasive species of Asian wasp given the sensationalist nickname Murder Hornet, discovered in British Columbia and Washington State. But as Coast Alaska's Jacob Resnick reports, entomologists in Alaska doubt the Asian giant hornets will make it this far north.
Pictures of the Asian giant hornet are nothing short of terrifying. The face of the 2-inch insect looks malevolent, and it is. It preys on honeybees, capable of devouring colonies in a few hours. That said, unprovoked attacks on humans and livestock are rare. But its sheer size and ability to sting through most beekeeper suits makes it a formidable pest, and agricultural officials in the U.S. and Canada are working to make sure it doesn't get established in North America. Alaska isn't known to be hospitable to outside species. University of Alaska Fairbanks entomologist Derek Sykes says he doesn't see the Asian giant hornet adapting to Alaska's cold climate. But in some parts of the panhandle, the temperature is fairly mild.
So the question then becomes, okay, what about southeast Alaska, which is, you know, the warmest? And there, you know, that's where it has the highest chance of succeeding, but even there, it's very small.
Dubbed in recent days by some media outlets as so-called murder hornets, its northern range of habitat is in Russia's Far East and Japan.
And that's the same latitude as, you know, Washington and Oregon.
Two nests were discovered last fall on Vancouver Island in British Columbia.
and those nests were eradicated.
That's Gail Wallen, Executive Director of the Invasive Species Council of British Columbia. The nests were found last fall near the island city of Nanaimo, about 400 miles south of Ketchikan.
Nobody knows for sure how they got here. So were they a hitchhiker on, you know, a shipping container? Were they a hitchhiker in somebody's cargo that they were bringing back from a trip to Asia? Or were they intentionally introduced because somebody brought them in because they wanted a collection of Asian giant hornets because they wanted an exotic pet?
Agricultural authorities in Washington state have confirmed sightings of the pest near Blaine, near the Canadian border. Wallen says BC officials are working with neighboring states, provinces, and territories to track and eliminate these and other invasive pests.
The species don't recognize any of the borders, so the more we can work together, the better off we are.
The Centers for Disease Control cites more than 1,100 deaths by wasp and bee stings between 2000 and 2017. The last two recorded fatal wasp attacks in Alaska were both near Fairbanks in 2006. Reporting in Juneau, I'm Jacob Resnick.
Yeah, keep them out of here. Here's some tips. Some friends in Indiana have put together some tips on how you can protect yourself from scammers.
Welcome to Better Beware. Here's your consumer watchdog from WFHB Community Radio with the latest information and helpful hints designed to keep your head out of the clouds, your feet on the ground, and your money in your pocket.
Here's your lockdown update. How are you doing? I'm okay, and I hope you are too. Let's face it, the COVID-19 outbreak has been a major interruption in all our lives, and for many, the shutdown has been a financial disaster. But you know what it's been for scammers and swindlers? It's a bonanza! It's getting wild out there, and not just in the West. The FTC reports that Americans across the country have already lost some $12 million to fraudsters who have more con games going than Pa Cartwright had cattle. The FBI has taken down hundreds of phony websites, but more show up every day. Here's a quick rundown on the most common scams. You get a text message. You've come in contact with someone who may be infected. This is bogus every time. Ignore it, erase it, and do not respond. Text messages, robocalls, and emails are trying to sell you home test kits, coronavirus treatments, investments in a breakthrough cure or vaccine, none of which exist at all, and some even offer toilet paper at 10 times the usual price. Look, if there is a vaccine or treatment, you'll hear about it first on the news, not from some stranger. There's a deluge of messages that seem to come from the government, preying on your financial anxiety. The Social Security Administration is stopping your payments. The Centers for Disease Control or the World Health Organization need donations. Even the FCC Financial Care Center wants to give you 30,000 smackers in relief money if you give them your bank account numbers. The FCC? The Federal Communications Commission? That's crazy. The FCC has nothing to do with individuals. This year, they're busy renewing the licenses of every radio and TV station in Indiana, including this one. The stimulus payments we are getting have the crooks salivating like a dog eyeing a T-bone steak. They'll offer to get you your payment faster, for a fee, of course, or demand payment for something they claim you've ordered. They'll tell you someone you love needs help, and it will be someone you love because they've hacked somebody's email address file, and they want you to buy gift cards, which they will forward. Right. This is the time to be super suspicious. Remember, the government contacts you with a letter in the mail, not on the phone and not by email. If you respond, call only publicly listed phone numbers. Don't follow any directions in a message. Pay for things with a credit card or not at all. If you're stuck at home, stick it to the bad guys and let this episode have a happy ending. I'm Richard Fish for WFHB News and Public Affairs.
Better Beware comes to you from WFHB Bloomington, Indiana. Find all our episodes at WFHB.org. If you can help put the kibosh on a con, email beware@WFHB.org. Remember, swindlers never give a sucker an even break.
Put the kibosh on a con. Wasn't that fun? I feel like watching some Bonanza episodes now. Let's find out what's happening from Alaska Fish Radio today.
This is Fish Radio. I'm Lainey Welch. Fisher or fishermen? What do they prefer? I'll tell you more after this.
Grundins urges everyone to buy seafood directly from community-supported fisheries at localcatch.org. Your CSF purchases will help U.S. fishing towns thrive. Grundins, supporting fisheries around the world since 1926.
Our language has evolved to try and become more gender neutral and politically correct. For example, policeman to police officer, fireman to firefighter, and more recently, fisherman to fisher. Federal and state documents and media reports all use the word fishers frequently today. Fish Radio asked Kodiak men and women who fish for a living how they feel about the more gender neutral name change.
I enjoy the term fisherman. I'd much rather be called a fisherman than be called a fisherwoman. It separates me as crew. I want to be treated like a crew member.
As a woman, I've always considered myself a fisherman. My dad taught me how to fish, and I feel like it is important to many families, especially father-daughter relationship. I think it should stay the way it is.
Historically, the word man is actually generic for men and women. It defines a human being, or the family of man. Do fishing people find fisher man offensive?
I think we put too much weight on the gender bias thing, and it shouldn't be there. Accept people for who they are. Why do we have to change it because somebody's offended?
It's been used for hundreds of years. Whether you're a fisher guy or you're a fisher woman, it's always been used to fishermen. It's obviously, like I said, it has to be of a woman who is not tied into the fisheries. It's got to be.
A fisherman's a fisherman. That's just the term. This gender neutral has gone too far.
I'm offended to change.
Some had suggestions for more acceptable gender terms.
I think fisherman, you eliminate the women, but fisher is not it.
If fisherman has got to go, fisher person would be just fine. And if a woman wants to be called fisher lady, I think that that would be acceptable as well.
Fisherman is a fisherman is a fisherman and will always be a fisherman. Whether it's female, boy, child, man, woman, it doesn't really matter.
Find links at AlaskaFishRadio.com.
Fish Radio is also brought to you by Ocean Beauty Seafoods, serving Alaska's fishing communities since 1910. In Kodiak, I'm Lainey Welch.
This is the Island Messenger, a look at personal messages, the weather, and community announcements.
Weather outside is glorious. If you like this kind of weather, it's just a great day. 44 degrees, light rain, fog, misty, about 85% humidity, 4 miles of visibility, and some little wind, little rain. It's currently, we've got showers likely, it says. That has come true. 70% chance of precipitation. That's come true. Cloudy skies with a high near 48. That's, we're not up there as of yet. We're still at 44 here in the studio. Outside the studio. Tonight, scattered showers, cloudy skies, low around 44. Northeast winds 15 to 20 miles an hour with a 50% chance of precipitation. Climbs up to 60% for tomorrow. Showers likely before 10 in the morning, but clouds a high near 50. Northeast winds 15 to 20 miles an hour. 5th of May, sun up 6:07, goes down at 10:07. That makes the math easy. 16 hours flat today. We've hit 16 hours of daylight. 4 minutes and 30 seconds more than we had yesterday. 69 was the high in 2004. 26 in the 1920 was the low. The synopsis for the North Gulf Coast and Kodiak Island waters issued at 3 o'clock this morning. 996 millibar low, 375 nautical miles south of Middleton Island, moves to 300 nautical miles south of Kodiak Wednesday morning, and then dissipates. A 1,000 millibar low, 250 nautical miles southwest of Ketchikan Tuesday night, moves 230 miles north southwest of Sitka and dissipates Wednesday afternoon. Barron Island's East Small Craft Advisory through Wednesday. Northeast 25 9-foot seas this afternoon. Northeast 25 10-foot seas tonight. East 20 9-foot seas Wednesday. Small Craft Advisory through Wednesday. Marmon Island to Sitkanak as well. Northeast 30 with 11-foot seas this afternoon. Northeast 25 11-foot seas tonight. Northeast 25 11-foot seas tomorrow. Chiniac Bay today, northeast 26-foot seas, rain showers. Tonight, northeast 26-foot seas, no rain showers. Tomorrow, northeast 26-foot seas, no rain showers. Marmot Bay, northeast 27-foot seas, rain showers today. Northeast 27-foot seas tonight, and east winds 20 knots, 7-foot seas tomorrow. Shelikov Strait, small craft advisory through Wednesday. Northeast 39-foot seas this afternoon. Northeast 25 9-foot seas tonight. Northeast 25 9-foot seas on Wednesday. In the Kodiak District, we're due a high tide here at 1:20 this afternoon of about 8 feet. Evening low tides at 7, 12.05 feet. The Euganic tide's at 1:48 this afternoon. It's a 15-footer, and the evening low tide's just before 8 o'clock, minus 0.82 feet. A couple of announcements, not too many. If you have announcements, please send them on to us. I know there's things are compressed. But first off, this Brecken project, you probably saw some signs if you went out past the airport yesterday. There's some signs from there to the flats saying that construction's going to be happening. This project started yesterday and runs through the end of August. We expect traffic delays, road restrictions, flaggers, and pilot vehicles as the project progresses. So if you're just in the area, be attentive when you're driving and know that it's going to last for a while. These five scholarships, the deadline is Friday. Five scholarships of $500 will be awarded for people who have need due to the shutdown. They'll notify people via email and phone. If you are a winner, you have to apply by Friday with a Kodiak address attached to a photo ID on the application. You apply online at kodiakcommunity.org. We're going to go right into the Shakespeare's on Talk of the Rock.
Listen for the Island Messenger here on Public Radio KMXT three times a day, Monday through Friday at 9 a.m., during the Midday Report at 12:20, and in the evening at 7 o'clock. If you have a community announcement or personal message, including lost and found items or pets, you can call KMXT at 486-3181, fax us at 486-2733, or email psa@kmxt.org.